Good morning. Today is Wednesday. It is 9:30 a.m. and this is March 25th, and this is the morning session of the Portland City Council. Glad you're all here. Carla, will you please call the roll?
Fish?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Leonard? Saltzman? Adams?
Here. Could you please read the... Oh, we have some special guests today, if they would come forward. Welcome to the City Council. Please introduce yourselves and tell us about the project that you're working on and spending a day here in city government.
Thank you, Mayor Adams and Commissioner Council members. My name is Mark Jackson, Director of REAP, Reaching and Empowering All People. And today we are focusing on our Leadership Institute with our students in our program, and we focus on civic engagement and business education. So we have Chris Oldham from Reynolds High School, who's here with us this morning to kind of share a testimony about his impact in REAP and his goals in life. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Oldham, and I would like to tell you about where I stood before REAP and where I stood after REAP. Before REAP, I was not too good of a student. I had bad attendance, and I was considering dropping out. My transcript says that I had a 1.5 my first year, and I had a 1.6 the next year. And then the year after that, my junior year, that's when REAP came to our school. My GPA went to a 1.8. And this year, my GPA is at a 3.1.
Nice.
So since REAP has came, REAP has motivated me and gave me a purpose. My purpose is to lead other people and tell them about my points of view and inform them about, you know, what I think is right and what I think is wrong. And I think they made a big impact in my life because I was considering dropping out. I wouldn't have graduated on time if it wasn't for REAP. And that's why I'm grateful to be in the program.
Very well said.
Appreciate it. And we'll be here much of the day interacting with different staff, and we're going to be glad to be here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Carla, would you please read the title for Council Item 294?
Request of Cheryl Dilnick to address Council regarding Mayor Adams. Cheryl?
Ms. Dilnick?
She's coming.
Good morning. Welcome to the City Council. Welcome back. Glad you're here.
How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. You just have to give us your first and last name, and you'll have 3 minutes.
My name is Cheryl Dilnick. And the last time I was here, I really didn't get to say everything I wanted to say. So I wanted to revisit the situation that you find yourself in today. And I guess as a woman, the first thing that irritated me in your apology was you were so flip about it and insulted me by not considering it city business, because I definitely believe it is. And as a woman, I guess I've been avoiding, let's call them creeps, since I was about 10 years old, adult men trying to take advantage of me. And to let you know how it feels, I guess would be explaining or how you would feel about having sex with a woman. That's how it feels. It feels like you're on hot rocks, but yet you're ice cold, and you just want to get out of the way. So in your situation, to be so flip about it, I thought, well, what would make you feel like it was okay? And I don't know what your experience is as a young person, but I just feel it was inappropriate the way you consider it. And also being a straight daughter of a gay man is a whole nother issue. I don't consider myself a homophobe. Lord knows I wanted my father in my life, but as he told me, I really don't want to go there. I really don't want to go here, but I feel I have to. My father told me what it meant for him to be gay, and I try to set all that aside and give everybody the benefit of the doubt, and everybody has their own thoughts. But then here you are with the same thing that my father told me about. in your feel of what is appropriate and what is not, when I went to Hawaii with my dad in 95 after his heart attack, he wanted to go back one more time, and we were sitting in hulas. I don't know if you're familiar, but in all those years, I'd never once seen my father do anything inappropriate, no sexual contact with anyone until I was 45 years old. And trying to deal with that was really devastating. But I held my own until the point where he came on to someone. And this man told him, "You don't want to go there. I have AIDS." And my dad turned to that man. He says, "I don't care. I've lived a long life." And it just devastated. It was totally devastating. And I know that...
And your time is up.
My time is up. I'll be back again.
I really appreciate your testimony today.
Because I want to talk about ethics, too.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
Carla, can you please read the title for council calendar item 295?
Request of Ron Peterson to address council regarding tenant and housing rights.
Mr. Peterson, welcome to the city council.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Glad you're here. You please have a seat. You'll have just give us your first and last name, and you'll have 3 minutes.
My name is Ron Peterson.
But I need you to sit down. Okay. So the cameras can get a good focus on you.
May I address the council with some visual aids?
Sure.
Thank you.
Carla will give it to us. Those are the rules.
Fair enough. That'll work. In regards to community, in regards to homelessness, in regards to parents, in regards to people that are bureaucrats, well-known throughout society, people that are local politicians, well-known within their community. Homelessness is a point of destitution where many people don't understand how to step back up and play the game again. Homelessness is a state of mind that people just can't seem to get past because they don't realize that they still can step back up on the game again. There are different types of people, and there are different types of places. Our parents don't train us to be homeless. There are many, 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 many different things. So we need someone to help stand up for us. We need someone that can step up. We need someone that can take hold of the reins. For those of us that aren't drug addicts, for those of us that really just want to try to get our lives back together, for those of us that really feel that we need a nice, comfortable, safe environment so that we can try to rebuild our lives, there are many, many issues that need to be dealt with here. And can I give the rest of my time back?
No.
Oh, well.
But you've got another 1 minute and 19 seconds.
I guess
you're doing very well. You should use the whole time.
I appeal to you, Mayor, in order to listen to the other people that are with me. We're all set on the same course, and I hope that the council will listen.
Did you want to tell us something about what's the packet that you just gave us?
Actually, no. I was using that as a visual aid from the bureaucrat to the local politician, from the parents, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you, Amanda. I hope that we can work something out. I know the stadium is an important deal. I know housing is an important deal. Maybe we can work out something for everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for having me.
Carla, could you please read the title for council calendar item 296?
Request of Anthony Anderson to address council regarding tenant and housing rights at Central City Concern.
Good morning, Mr. Anderson. Glad you're here. Just need to give us your first and last name. I need you to sit down, though.
Anthony Anderson. I live at the Biltmore Hotel, which is a Central City Concern property. I'm here to talk about the corruption within Central City Concern. The first time that I became aware of it was with the managers of the Biltmore. one Carol, a.k.a. Tutu. When she was fired, she, on a Friday, she, before our remodel of the hotel, our mail used to come in the managers would deliver it. Well, she hid the mail on Friday, and then she came in on Saturday. Central City Concern didn't take the keys away from her, and she hid the mail again. Her co-worker, Felicia Poe, would take the resident requests for maintenance and file them in the circular file, throw them away. When she was caught for doing that, they didn't fire her per se. They said that she made a lateral move to HAP. And then in April of 2006, I had a man named Scott Remillard move next to me. He was a drug dealer. Of course, I didn't know it right away, but he moved in with his girlfriend. We live in a single-room occupancy hotel, which means only one person per room. Well, having two people in a room obviously creates more noise, and that was my initial complaint. Later, I discovered that he would stay up all night because of always being high on drugs. Anyway, in the course of time, I became aware that the desk monitor, whose job was to prevent such things from happening, was actually feeding him information when I would report things, what was going on. He'd feed it to the drug dealer, so he's working in tandem with him. Central City Concern would deny that anything was happening, and they didn't do anything about it. Anyway, so I started reporting to the guy above him, Lerone Polk, and for a while there, he would just act like he was surprised that there was drug dealing going on in the building. But when he was fired some 2 months later, I saw him in the building 2 days later, and he was up there to buy drugs from one of the other drug dealers in the building. Central City Concern tried to suppress my testimony when I told them about what was happening in the building, the drug dealing, by saying that they didn't have the resources to investigate things. And then when I investigated what was going on, they said that I wasn't supposed to do that either. I wasn't supposed to look out my room and see what was going on and report it. My time is almost out.
What would you like us to do?
I would like you to investigate Central City Concern, what they're doing. They are not properly representing the homeless, and they're misusing the funds, basically. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Really appreciate it. Carla, could you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 297?
Request of Joseph D. Pierce to address Council regarding tenant and housing rights.
Good morning, Mr. Pierce. Good morning. Welcome to the City Council.
Thank you. I want to thank the City Council for...
And your full name is Joseph Pierce.
D. Pierce.
Glad you're here.
Thank you. And this is the second time I've addressed City Council. The first was before Central City took over ownership and management of the Biltmore Hotel. And in my first address before City Council... I moved into the Biltmore just after Central City had previously been managing the building, and then it was taken over by Micah Properties, Mike and Karen. And I had told City Council exactly, you know, what it was like from the residents that lived there under Central City, and how it was different and better under private management. Central City took over, and it was kind of like the Marx Brothers doing an impersonation of Mother Teresa. So many things have gone wrong in their management style, we have so many difficulties, crime, drugs, and stuff like that. There's no screening of prospective tenants, no openness and transparency in the employee disciplines. And with the exception of the seismic upgrade, new paint and decor, we're a lot less safe, less healthy, and less serene than before. It is said that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Central City Concern has plenty of good intentions fabulous PR and money on demand. But that's the problem is it's not better than it used to be. In fact, some things have gotten a lot worse. And I'm hoping that the people will at City Council and those in the know will make the Biltmore stop having the reputation of being the notorious Biltmore Hotel as a nice place for people to live there. I've lived there since 1990-91, and it's not the best place to live. People are ashamed to come and visit me. And so thank you very, very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Carla, could you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 298?
Request of Lou Church to address Council regarding tenant and housing rights.
Good morning, Mr. Church.
Morning, Sam.
That's fine.
Welcome to the City Council.
My name's Lou Church. I'm with a coordinator of PSU Progressive Student Union. And we've been talking with and helping organize tenants of Central City since last summer. And tenants have been meeting the last 3 months every Sunday night and formed a group called Tenant Rights Project. You've heard some comments from Ron in general about homelessness and trying to negotiate possible solutions to what many tenants feel is a problem with Central City. Joe and Anthony outlined some of the mismanagement and crime concerns. One of the primary issues is pest control. I'm not sure that the current City Council really has heard from tenants recently. I know Joe said he talked a long time ago, probably when none of the current council members were on the council. Central City has a number of practices. Persistent pest control problems in a number of the buildings. Ed Blackburn was recently interviewed by Channel 12 by Jim Hyde regarding that, and we feel these problems are systemic and not being addressed. I want to try to make some other comments as well. We're basically addressing council today because we feel the council, being Portland, that this particular council is liberal and progressive. We recognize that that Nick Fish is in charge of housing, and so we'll try to be contacting his staff regarding our concerns about this. One of the most activist liberal teachers that I've taken classes from is Patricia Schechter, so we can also talk to Patricia about our concerns with this. She's also helped on a number of projects we worked on just at Portland State.
And she also is my wife.
And we know that. And I was surprised. I was surprised that you get to talk in this format.
She didn't want to take my name when we got married because she didn't want to be known as Trish Fish.
Sure. And I understand that you all moved here because she got the job at PSU.
By the way, this won't be credited against your time, but I'm actually here.
Yeah, it looks like the time stopped. But yeah.
I'm actually here since I'm very proud of my wife who teaches history at PSU, but we're here because Portland State offered her a position.
Right. Well, and I think some of us are glad that you're in council. It sounds like that you had a relative who was on the Watergate committee at one point, Hamilton Fish.
My father, yeah.
Right. Okay, so to continue. I personally voted for Amanda because I think the activist community in Portland hopes that Amanda will be the future leadership of the council in terms of, and not to be, I don't know, highfalutin about it, but in terms of people like Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King, Saul Alinsky, Bobby Kennedy, Maxine Waters, and George Wiley, who used to be a coordinator of an organization called National Welfare Rights Organization. We appreciate what Randy Leonard's office apparently did with the Stewart Hotel, getting heat turned on during the snowstorm in December. And we hope that Dan and Sam live up to what we perceive to be the perception of the council being liberal and progressive despite the soccer vote. One solution to Central City problems that we proposed, which we think, as noted, are systemic, is splitting the corporation off. It has a $33 million budget. Is that the end? I see it. Show 30. It's splitting the corporation off. Basically, there's recovery, which constitutes 60% of the $33 million budget, and 40% of the budget goes for housing. And if there were two separate corporations or NGOs, we feel much more attention we address to tenant rights and housing. One of the things that, as a funding source for Central City, that Nick or council might be able to do is Central City has a rule against tenants talking at board meetings. We think tenants ought to be able to talk to Central City at their board meetings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Church.
You can call me Lou.
Thank you, Lou.
Mayor, may I just take a moment just to give the council a quick update? First of all, I want to thank everyone who came forward today to speak before council and appreciate what they said. We've taken notes specifically about the concerns, but I just want to respond briefly. When this appeared on our agenda, I asked Central City Concern to come in and to meet with me to explain what we may likely hear today and what some of the issues are, and they did. And they are one of our best nonprofit partners in the housing arena. They came in, we sat down. The Biltmore Hotel, just so everyone knows, is a project-based Section 8 building with about 76 units. It's an older building, and it is in our continuum of care. It's what we call a low-barrier facility with no sobriety requirements. So it is used to house some of the more challenging people in our community that we have trouble finding at a proper placement for. It is not a place without challenges, and we recognize that. As the housing commissioner, what I would want to say is that what some of the issues that have been identified go to the heart of something that we talk about all the time, which is, you know, do we have enough resources to match housing with services? Because without services, we are not meeting the needs. And I don't want to just turn this into a plug for my budget request, but I'd be remiss if I didn't at least frame the issue that the service component of what we do is what makes the housing work. And Central City Concern is asked to do a very important job with inadequate resources. And so I'll be coming back to you talking about the services side of the equation. But because of the issues that have been framed, I just want to note for the record that we've asked that three things happen as a result of the concerns that you've raised. I've asked Central City Concern to provide some documentation to my bureau, the Housing Bureau, concerning the code and safety issues which have been raised, so we will be reviewing that. The Bureau of Development Services has agreed to provide inspections for tenants who have a pest issue and believe there's a problem. BDS inspectors are and will take a look to see whether those issues have been adequately addressed. And to those of you who are here and to those who live there, you know, I urge you to use and access community resources like the Community Alliance of Tenants and other folks who are advocates for tenants in buildings. My job isn't to make a judgment on these things. My job and the city's job is to make sure that everybody who is housed directly or indirectly by the city has a decent place to call home. But I appreciate the issues being brought forward. We think very highly of Central City Concern and the job they're doing. We take your concerns very seriously, particularly around bed bugs, which is a larger problem in our community that affects lots of our housing for a whole variety of reasons. You have my commitment that we will pay attention to your concerns and address them. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Carla, would you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 299?
Do you want to do the consent agenda?
Could you please read? Oh, consent agenda. Thank you. I understand that item 308 is requested to be pulled back to Commissioner Saltzman's office. Unless objections, so done. Any other items anyone wishes to pull from the consent agenda? Hearing none, Carla, would you please call the roll?
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Consent agenda is approved. Now, would you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 299?
Assess benefited properties for street and traffic calming improvements in the Southeast 152nd Avenue Local Improvement District.
This project was initiated by the city in lieu of a petition. It was formed. We formed the LID in 2006 and were able to buy down the cost of the project by $225,000 by moving quickly to use developer money. The land that was to be developed is now one of the newest acquisitions by the Parks Bureau and will forever be green space. Our thanks to Commissioner Saltzman and Paul Grosjean of the Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association, who's here with us. Key objective of the project is to improve fire and medical response. Previously, only one way in and out to serve 400 homes, and now we will have two access points to meet fire codes, but the project also had multiple objectives: pedestrian improvement, stormwater treatment, and allowing some of the remaining parcels to be developed in a safe way. I'll now turn it over to Andrew and Chief Klum.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. Andrew Abbey, Local Improvement District Administrator. Good morning, Council members. I just passed out a short presentation to Carla. Just want to make a couple of findings for the record. First of all, I wanted to start with a geographical overview. The Southeast 152nd Avenue LID is shown there in the center of the map. You can see that the Hawthorne Ridge and adjacent neighborhoods are just south of Foster Road. The three traffic signals that you see there on Foster Road are projects that the Portland Bureau of Transportation has completed within the past decade. On the left is the signal at Barbara Welch Road, which was the most recently completed project and was a key project for providing safe egress to the neighborhood via Southeast 152nd Avenue. We also completed signal projects at 162nd and Foster, as well as at Jenny Road on Foster, but none of these projects were funded by a local improvement district. So here's an overview of the resources that we spent building those three other traffic signals. You can see that we have spent a total, including the Southeast 152nd Avenue LID, of $10 million in the area. The proposed assessment for Southeast 152nd Avenue is $1 million. So the city has certainly invested a lot of resources in the area, but the majority of the resources have not come from this or other local improvement districts. This is a close-up view of the Southeast 152nd Avenue LID. We have multiple assessment zones in the LID reflecting differing levels of benefit. I'd like to call your attention to the pink circle kind of on the right side of the map there. That previously was the only egress for properties in this area. So all of the traffic had to go out through that intersection of Henderson and Flavelle Way. If you look at the bottom left-hand corner of the screen, you'll see a green circle. That is the second egress route that we have built for the neighborhood. And then finally, I just wanted to point out that the properties in pink on the left side of the map are in the future development abutting zone, and completion of this LID will enable those properties to be developed. It is unlikely that they would receive permission to develop in the absence of improving 152nd Avenue, but at minimum, they would avoid a requirement to put sprinkler systems in all of the houses if they were to be allowed to be developed without 152nd being open. And then the properties there in purple, kind of at the bottom to the right of the green circle, that is other future development as well. And completing 152nd Avenue more evenly distributes the traffic through the neighborhood in lieu of this area becoming a future egress route, sole future egress route, when they build a connection to Barbara Welch Road. So just to recap the extent of the project scope, we built both full and half street improvements. The full street improvement provide a new secondary routine and emergency access route. The half street improvements north of Henderson Way, we used to have about 14 feet of pavement there. So we had two-way traffic trying to crowd onto 14 feet of pavement. That has now been widened. So we have reduced the potential for head-on collisions. We have also built new sidewalks connecting to a school bus stop at Barbara Welch and 152nd. This area is straddled by two school districts, Centennial and David Douglas. And we have also done extensive stormwater management. As we got into the project, we really began to appreciate how much stormwater was coming off the hill. I would think of this as the east side version of the Southwest Texas Green Street LID in terms of the complexity of the project scope. We also added street lighting and traffic calming. Perhaps most importantly, I wanted to share with you some preliminary findings on emergency response calls. We've had an unusually high number of emergency response calls since the road was opened in December. We've had 6 medical calls and 1 fire call. It's too early for conclusive findings, but so far we've found that the response time had declined from 8 minutes to 6 minutes, which is a 25% reduction and quite substantial. In terms of the apportionment of benefit, these are the basic principles: that the new development is paying a higher rate than existing development, and abutting pays a higher rate than not abutting properties. And most of the properties in the LID, if you go back to that original map, are in the central assessment zone. There's a small number of homes in the east assessment zone that are closest to 162nd that pay one-third the rate of the properties in the central assessment zone. In terms of the objections to final assessment, this was a very large LID. We had 440 assessable properties. We received objections to final assessment from 9 properties whose assessments represented less than 1% of the proposed final assessment amount, and none of those assessment amounts were over $679.96. Just wanted to wrap up here.
What kind of time frame was the 600 and some dollars? Over the entire thing, per month, per year?
No, that's the entire amount of the assessment for those properties. Thank you. And I just wanted to close by showing you some before and after pictures. You can see there the larger picture on the left is what 152nd looked like in the winter of 2001. In the upper right-hand corner, you see barricades that were placed by a private property owner preventing access to 152nd. You can see all that water coming off of the hill that's now being dealt with and treated. You can also see that for sale sign in front of that house that never did sell amid a very hot housing market. This is a picture of last week. You can see that we built new sidewalks to provide school children and in the neighborhoods with access to their school bus stop. In the upper right-hand corner, you see one of our new swales that we built to sustainably deal with stormwater. And in the bottom right-hand picture, you can see a sidewalk that we built on Barbara Welch Road to serve as a safe place for children to wait for the school bus on Barbara Welch Road. So that wraps up my presentation. I'm joined today by Chief Klum of the Fire Bureau. Chief Klum, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, John Klum, Fire Chief. Just want to talk a little bit briefly about the importance of what that reduction in response times that we've seen. Capturing the data for a 3-month period and having 7 emergency responses into this area that had been challenging for Station 29 because of the type of grade that with the single point of access in and out of that area of 18% was critical because what statistics have shown that if we can reduce our response times to critical care patients of 6 minutes or under, the likelihood of the survivability rate increases drastically. And so it's huge going from the 8 minute to 6 minutes. But please keep in mind that we had a significant winter event during this, and so we anticipate our response times will even improve further than that. But as far as not only increasing the survivability of the care that Portland Fire gives on critical care calls, but it's also getting to residential fires pre-flashover. And that 6 minutes also plays into that, which drastically increases firefighter safety, reduces property damage, allows our firefighters to get in there and extricate people in a timely fashion prior to the flashover where most of our lives are lost. Another significant issue took place recently, too, with the improvements to Jenny Road. Although it was my understanding that they're getting close to completion or near completion, is that in effect, cut off the primary response route from our second in due company into that area. And how that is significant is that when Station 29 is out and other companies have to approach from the south and from the west components in there, is that this makes a secondary means of getting into this area even more critical so they don't have to backtrack and come back around. So we see it as extremely positive, and we're looking forward to actually capturing a whole year's data on this particular improvement, and it really improved service delivery into that area. Thank you.
Thank you. Discussion with council? Thank you, gentlemen.
I just wanted to add I received 2 untimely objections, and those are in a memo that I just asked Carla to pass out to you. Thank you.
I do have a question on one of those. I just was able to read it, and there's a concern about the tree planting not being done yet. And in the response, it says that the tree planting and the planter strips is scheduled for May.
Yes.
Is there any possibility of doing it earlier than that? Because Friends of Trees usually...
We work with Urban Forestry to plant the trees on a timeline that maximizes the survivability of the trees. And so what we didn't want to be in a position of doing is planting the trees this winter when it was colder out and less likely that they would survive for their two-year establishment period. The other thing is urban forestry has a schedule of when they harvest trees from the nursery, so we kind of have to work around nature's schedule rather than our schedule.
I think from my experience with Friends of Trees and with other plantings that they suggest you do it during the cold months because then they have a chance to establish before it gets hot. So if there is a possibility to look at that, I think that would be good.
Thank you.
Is anyone signed up?
Yes, we have two people signed up, Paul Groshon and Alan Abramson.
Paul? Alan? Welcome back to the City Council.
Thank you.
Why don't you go ahead and begin?
I've been involved in seeking a solution to the transportation. I'm sorry, Paul Groshon. Last week I didn't have to do that. I've been involved in seeking a solution to the transportation issues of Clatsop Butte and the 400-some-odd homes since I moved here 10 years ago. The design of the road system was flawed from the very beginning, as the system was designed by the developer and approved by the city, providing only one road in and one road out. In fact, it's my understanding that the development would not even pass for current fire code without the installation of sprinklers in each house. In the years that have passed, we have suffered through numerous periods of extended isolation during periods of inclement weather where our single road was blocked. Fire and ambulance calls were delayed or indeed made impossible. I've witnessed police cars unable to respond and other issues of similar nature. When the neighborhood approached city officials many years ago, we were informed that it was up to the residents to fund the solution. That was not the solution we sought. Few people would approve self-taxation to solve an issue they consider a government responsibility, such as roads. However, there was no option, so eventually we petitioned City Council for this LID. It opened, as noted, in mid-December on the eve of the snow event. It could not have come at a more opportune time. Residents had finally an alternative route when there was a disruption. While the vast majority of the residents are supportive of the new road, there is resentment on the financial obligation. When this project was approved by council, it was expected to be constructed in 2007. Instead, in order to make it more organized and possibly more economical, it was planned for 2008. But a lot of the speed opportunities were lost. It was not done during warm weather. And as a result of that, we still don't have the trees planted that were planned for last year, and we still don't have completed speed bumps. So I don't consider it to be a completed project. Bottom line is the road is now open, and we get the benefit of this new transportation. And the emergency response times will be reduced. Actually, it's now proven that they have been reduced. I wish there was a better way to handle transportation issues such as this. A neighborhood only 10 years old should not have to shoulder a very expensive correction of design flaws in the original city-approved plan affecting safety and critical transportation issues that we have faced since day one. I would also make a request that before the final assessment is approved, that we, as the Neighborhood Association, has an opportunity to review the budget, not just an individual assessment, but on a more global nature.
Happy to provide you with that commitment. And just by way of background, it is true for most every neighborhood in the city that the developer at the time of the subdivision pays for the roads, the gutters, the curbs, and the sidewalks, or after the fact when that's not done with LIDs. So the city doesn't, it only on the main arterials does the city invest what little money we have into the streets and roads.
I understand that.
Thanks, Paul.
We have one more person, Keith Derringer.
Good morning. Welcome to the City Council.
Good morning. Keith Derringer. Yeah, I've been a long-time resident actually prior to the heavy development that occurred up there. And actually years ago when they started the project, the company, I believe they went bankrupt, but they actually offered me, they said, hey, you give us the land, we'll throw the road, sidewalk, all in for free. And I was actually for that. I thought, you know, that's probably the best way to go. But unfortunately, they didn't seem to have the money, and it never went through. Anyway, part of my objection to this situation is I have probably the highest amount being billed to me, and they, when I say they, the city stated that highest and best use was 22 homes on my property, and I'm not sure where they come out with that because, first of all, me as the consumer or the purchaser of the property, I was not into development and, you know, cramming 450 homes on so much land, or, you know, I didn't think of the economics of the value of my home. I thought of it more as a place where I could go that was a little ways away from the city, but yet in the city. And here all of a sudden, these large neighborhoods appear, and it seems to me like the road is primarily for them, along with some future development on top of me. And some of my thoughts were, you know, for me to be charged $109,000+, and then the neighbors maybe $2,000, whatever it is, I'm not even sure what they're being charged. I just feel like, you know, that's not a fair part of the portion for the improvement. I feel their pain. Concerning the use I have of it, I'm the only one living in that home, and I feel like the usage of my property might be best having heavy development, but economically and environmentally, I don't believe that's true. I feel the impact from what's already occurred up there with actual springs that have popped into my property that never existed before, along with some other water problems. It's the first time in 2008, December, I had flooding of my daylight basement. My home was built in 69 on the six-acre parcel. And a lot of problems actually occurred from the fact they built this large neighborhood, and I don't think they realize some of the impact on the environment, including Johnson Creek right down the street. Some of the situation I look at is, why wasn't a little more thought put on this? And as far as the project being completed, the tree bit, I haven't heard about that. I don't know where they impose having these trees. If it's down on the property they would label as mine or not. But certainly that would beautify the area because a lot of my screenage was eliminated. And I feel like there's other problems that really have never been looked at. As far as the project being complete, I've asked the city, with the city folks being up there, a number of times, including last week where they took pictures of...
I apologize, but you're over your time if you just wrap up here.
Oh, okay. Completing the sidewalk would be nice. It's still a dangerous situation with no barricades, and with my experience with putting sidewalks on city property, they require me to have barricades. There's no barricades, and the sidewalk's still empty. I believe PGE, they're blaming on that, but it's still not complete. Okay. As far as assessment, I feel the assessment is unfair. I think the $109,000 I'm being charged is way over, considering it's environmentally conservative area. It's called R10C, which means I couldn't build 22 homes on it. And today's situation with building homes, I don't think it'd be a good idea anyway. A lot of the land has hills in it.
Okay.
Some serious stuff, though, needs to still be looked at here. And I think even further down, there's some problems.
Thank you, sir. Andrew, you want to come up and respond to that or provide us some additional information?
A couple of things. With respect to speed bumps, we installed speed bumps last year. We installed two-inch high speed bumps. We're going to add an extra inch this spring to bring it up to a 3-inch lift on the speed bumps. All of the sidewalks have been constructed. The sidewalk piece to which Mr. Derringer referred is a piece that we could not install because a transformer, electrical transformer serving his property was in the way. It's up to PGE to relocate that transformer, and at such time that they relocate it, then it'll be up to PGE to put in that missing sidewalk panel. So also, I just wanted to note, so Mr. Garrett,
they have a responsibility to do that.
Yes.
Okay. And how do we get them to do that?
Well, they're operating facilities in our public right-of-way, so they operate under the city's franchise agreement.
You'll follow up on that and make sure it happens.
Yes. And then finally, I just wanted to note, Mr. Derringer does have the highest non-city assessment in the LID. We spent a lot of money on right-of-way acquisition for this project, and Mr. Derringer was compensated for his right-of-way. Had he not participated in this LID, then he, in the future, when he developed his property, he would have been required to dedicate that right-of-way for free and not get compensated for it.
How much should be compensated?
I don't have my numbers here in front of me, but I think it was in the area of $40,000 or so. Yeah. And then finally, if you were to divide his assessment by the number of properties that he could build on his lot, it works out to four figures per property. Another vacant lot two doors away platted 24 lots. So, Mr. Derringer, we assume, could build 27.
Did you take into account the conservation overlay?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other discussion from council? All right, this moves. Is there additional discussion?
Yeah, I'd like to just make some comments.
Sure. I just want to clarify, this moves to a second reading, right, Carla? Okay.
Right. So I'm just going to make some comments while everybody's here. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your testimony. I think in any situation like this, the question is who pays, who benefits, and is that fair? And looking at the numbers, it's about $1.7 million total, of which about $1 million is from property owners, $440,000 from environmental services from ratepayers citywide for the stormwater and vegetation improvements, $22,000 from the general fund for curb cuts and sidewalks, and then $257,000 from the transportation department. So it's roughly two-thirds from the property owners and one-third from the public at large and other city revenue. I do have the question that share the concern about this. A lot of this development is only 10 years old, and why at the time of development we didn't require these kinds of improvements that we need to, and I know Commissioner, when Mayor Adams was Commissioner Adams, he was looking at that process, and we still need to do that. And working with Development Services with Commissioner Leonard, that when development is done, we need to have the improvements made, because the process of having waivers and putting the burden on the property owners just doesn't work. It's really great that this project has been able to be funded in part by public money as well as by property owners, but I still think that there's work to be done. I'm also glad that this improvement has been done and that it's already been proven to be successful. So thank you very much, everybody, for your work.
Unless there's additional council discussion, 299 moves to a second reading next week. Carla, could you please read the title for council calendar item 300?
Update responsibilities for the proper management and preservation of city records, including electronic records.
Auditor Blackmer, welcome to the City Council. City Attorney Linda Mang, welcome to the City Council. Mark, welcome to the City Council.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. We're bringing forward to you revisions to the City Code regarding records management, and the purpose of this presentation is to inform City Council about the background of this initiative. With me is Linda Mang, the City Attorney, and Mark Greinke, Director of Bureau of Technology Services. The city charter assigns city records to my office, regardless of the format or medium. Oregon law is becoming increasingly stringent on how public records, especially electronic records, need to be managed and preserved. And new federal laws are now dictating electronic information handling methods to ensure that during litigation they are available. In addition to the legal statutes dictating what we need to keep, we also have a historic preservation responsibility to maintain evidence of the city's activities, decisions, and policies. Whether this information is required by the public tomorrow, next year, or 100 years from now, it's our responsibility to ensure this correspondence and other records are safeguarded and properly managed. In the past, records were managed by secretaries who typed correspondence, made carbon copies, and indexed and filed them so they could be found when they were needed. Those centralized jobs are gone, and the responsibility for documenting our decisions and activities now falls to individual employees. However, the city has not established clear expectations, procedures, or training for its personnel to manage emails and other electronic documents in compliance with state and federal laws and our preservation responsibilities. The ordinance before you provides the framework for meeting our obligations. But what I'd like to do is give you a little bit of background. And so Linda Meng will talk for a couple of minutes about the special risks and challenges that are associated with electronic records from her perspective.
Good morning. I'm here to emphasize that the city has responsibilities from two separate but related legal obligations. The Oregon Public Records Law requires that documents be retained according to retention schedules for the type of document and not for the kind of medium that where it's created or stored, and that they be produced for inspection or copying when requested. Court procedures require that we be able to provide documents requested in discovery as part of litigation. That discovery is becoming broader and broader as the courts are allowing more leeway for a litigant. The court requirements focus on documents that exist at the time that the litigation is expected. Both public records law and litigation discovery require that we produce documents that exist when the request is received, whether or not under a retention schedule we might have been allowed to destroy them before the request came in. So if we have the documents, they're subject to being produced either in public records or litigation. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were recently amended to address production of electronically stored information, and there's a growing body of case law that deals with electronic discovery. Courts are expecting parties to be able to produce records in a timely and orderly manner. This includes relevant email and all other electronically stored documents wherever they exist. There are penalties for not doing so, ranging from imposition of substantial fines and costs to more draconian measures, such as an instruction to a jury to presume that there was wrongdoing because documents are not produced or cannot be found. An important aspect of the court's review of discovery issues is whether the party has records policies that are being followed. The rules provide that a court may not impose sanctions for failing to provide electronically stored information that is lost as a result of a routine, good faith operation of an electronic information system. The city has such a system, but these amendments are intended to update and improve that system.
Thank you.
Could I just make one comment, Linda, because in my previous life I was a litigator, and just to amplify what you said, it is now routine in litigation to go beyond just asking for, like, all the emails. It is now routine to ask to actually have the hardware and to ask to have the computer delivered so that a party's forensic person can go in and find out if anything's been deleted and recover information that may not be apparent. And as I've learned in some cases, computers that have absolutely no indication that there's anything on them, these high-tech people can actually recover things. Right. People think they've deleted or they've downloaded software to wipe the thing clean. Or even in some cases, they've damaged the hardware.
Right.
And it can still be recovered. So this is an area where people are really pushing the envelope in terms of wanting access to information, including taking the hardware and reviewing it.
Right. And the courts are much less likely to allow that kind of pushing into, you know, getting a hardware, doing forensic analysis, if the litigant is able to produce documents in an orderly fashion and if there's not any indication that documents have, you know, been messed with or destroyed. But if there's cases, for instance, where you say we've produced everything and then some third party brings in an email that you should have had and you don't have it, and then the courts are likely to think, well, you've either destroyed it or you're not playing by the rules. You know, you're not producing things. So there's a big push for doing that kinds of forensic analysis, and it is becoming more usual. It's not something that is a good thing to have happen. No. And so it's really important that we be able to produce the documents that we have and that we have the documents that we should have at the time that they're asked for.
The other thing I just want to note is that the problem with emails generally, in my experience, is that they're too easy to formulate and send. And then they have this viral capacity to be greatly expanded. I mean, it's someone can just click a button and send it to another 1,000 people. And I'm wondering whether at some point we need to put like some kind of disclaimer or cautionary note on our website that says if you send an email to a commissioner, A, it's a public record, you know, which someone can review, and B, you know, you might want to actually think about that when you compose it. I mean, I get certain emails which, you know, my skin is getting thicker. I realize people have a right to vent. But again, emails increasingly are things where people get, you know, put things down and send them without necessarily thinking about the lifespan of that document. And the fact that it's going to go into the archives and be available for people to review in the future might temper or might cause people to be a little more judicious in the way they compose their emails. But the other thing I think is really complicated for us is that in the course of our work, we get emails from a variety of sources that are privileged. And kind of sorting out, you know, how we store that stuff, if it comes from city attorney or if it's a labor relations matter, and how we maintain, store those, how we segregate them, because we can't keep them in the body of our other emails in case that's ever discovered. So in looking at these materials, I'm hoping that we're going to get some extensive training office by office, because these are technically very complicated. And I'm also hoping that as we, quote unquote, refresh Oregon Online this summer and look at our whole system, that we think about how we can make improvements in our systems to help us comply with these rules, particularly those of us getting 1,000 emails, you know, a day on various things.
Those are all good points, and those are things that we are working on. But I think one of the greatest challenges we have is when we get those requests for documentation, how we recover the emails. And Mark Grinke is going to talk about the challenges that his office faces when he's being asked to produce emails as a result of courts or other requests.
Well, as you know, BTS operates and maintains numerous technology systems that are vital for the day-to-day operation of city bureaus and offices. And I'm going to try to avoid too much geek speak here, but collectively these systems store over 44 terabytes of electronic data. This data includes all types of information, not just email messages, but 911 voice recordings, police records, engineering diagrams, spreadsheets and documents, and millions of emails. To put this in perspective, if printed on paper, it would take over 2 million trees to print this all this data out, and the stack of paper would be over 440 miles high. While BTS provides backup services to restore electronic data in the event of loss, backups alone do not adequately address the requirements to properly archive electronic data that is subject to public record laws and legal discovery requests. It's important to understand that records retention involves a systematic decision as to how long a record should be retained based on administrative, legal, and research needs. Contrast this with backup technologies where redundant copies of data are stored on alternate backup media regardless of the public records retention schedule. The purpose of backups is to be able to restore data and documents in the event of loss and failure. Backups include all electronic data on a system, whether the data is defined as a public record or not. The backup retention policy for most city electronic data is 6 months. However, public records have retention policies that can vary drastically. Examples include records that must be kept until superseded, some for 3 or 4 years, some for 75 years, and some are permanent. BTS is often asked to complete public records and litigation discovery requests of email messages, including those currently stored on our email servers, as well as those only kept on backup media. It can be particularly challenging to restore specific emails from backup media as these backup recovery tools were never designed for quickly accessing the proverbial needle in the haystack. These requests can be labor-intensive and they're time-consuming. We often need to search through, again, many different email servers and individual sets of backup media. Proper electronics records management tools are different. They not only address the requirements to maintain electronic records in alignment with those retention schedules, they enable city staff and, in many cases, the public, the ability to complete search requests on their own through our self-service tools. Simply put, BTS backup solutions provide for data protection and recovery, while records management tools provide for effective electronic records retention and retrieval. Although both technology solutions are needed for proper electronic data storage and management, they clearly serve different needs.
Gary, just ask two quick questions on
sure.
that. When you get a request for document for electronic documents that you could pull off the server, but that are technically housed in a, let's say, in a particular office, do you always contact the office about the request?